21. The tracks now bent southwest and ran through tangles of second-growth fir and heavy underbrush. We got a breakfast of late blackberries from some of these bushes, but berries never fill you up. Your stomach just gives them a 30-minute option and then begins growling again. We went back to the tracks. It was about 8 o'clock by then, and took five. Our mouths were a dark purple, and our naked torsos were scratched from the blackberry brambles. Vern wished glumly aloud for a couple of fried eggs with bacon on the side. That was the last day of the heat, and I think it was the worst of all. The early scud of clouds melted away, and by 9 o'clock the sky was a pale steel color that made you feel hotter just looking at it. The sweat rolled and ran from our chests and backs, leaving clean streaks through the accumulated soot and grime. Mosquitoes and black flies whirled and dipped around our heads in aggravating clouds. Knowing that we had long miles to go didn't make us feel any better, yet the fascination of the thing drew us on and kept us walking faster than we had any business doing in that heat. We were all crazy to see that kid's body. I can't put it any more simply or honestly than that. Whether it was harmless, or whether it turned out to have the power to murder sleep with 100 mangled dreams, we wanted to see it. I think that we had come to believe we deserved to see it. It was about 9:30 when Teddy and Chris spotted water up ahead. They shouted to Vern and me. We ran over to where they were standing. Chris was laughing, delighted. "Look there, beavers did that," he pointed. It was the work of beavers, all right. A large bore culvert ran under the railroad embankment a little way ahead, and the beavers had sealed the right end with one of their neat and industrious little dams, sticks and branches cemented together with leaves, twigs, and dried mud. Beavers are busy little fuckers, all right. Behind the dam was a clear and shining pool of water, brilliantly mirroring the sunlight. Beaver houses humped up and out of the water in several places. They looked like wooden igloos. A small creek trickled into the far end of the pool, and the trees which bordered it were gnawed a clean bone white to a height of almost 3 feet in places. "Railroad'll clean this shit out pretty soon," Chris said. "Why?" Vern asked. "They can't have a pool here," Chris said. "It'd undercut their precious railroad line. That's why they put that culvert in there to start with. They'll shoot 'em some beavers and scare off the rest, and then knock out their dam. Then this'll go back to being a bog like it probably was before." "I think that eats the meat," Teddy said. Chris shrugged. "Who cares about beavers? Not the great southern and western Maine, that's for sure." "You think it's deep enough to swim in?" Vern asked, looking hungrily at the water. "One way to find out," Teddy said. "Who goes first?" I asked. "Me," Chris said. He went running down the bank, kicking off his sneakers and untying his shirt from around his waist with a jerk. He pushed his pants and undershorts down with a single shove of his thumbs. He balanced first on one leg and then on the other to get his socks. Then he made a shallow dive. He came up shaking his head to get his wet hair out of his eyes. "It's fucking great!" he shouted. "How deep?" Teddy called back. He had never learned to swim. Chris stood up in the water and his shoulders broke the surface. I saw something on one of them, a blackish-grayish something. Decided it was a piece of mud and dismissed it. If I had looked more closely, I could have saved myself a lot of nightmares later on. "Come on in, you chickens!" He turned and thrashed off across the pool in a clumsy breaststroke, turned over and thrashed back. By then we were all getting undressed. Vern was in next, then me. Hitting the water was fantastic, clean and cool. I swam across to Chris, loving the silky feel of having nothing on but water. I stood up, and we grinned into each other's faces. "Boss!" We said it at exactly the same moment. "Fucking jerk off," he said, splashed water in my face, and swam off the other way. We goofed off in the water for almost half an hour before we realized that the pond was full of bloodsuckers. We dived, swam underwater, ducked each other. We never knew a thing. Then Vern swam into the shallower part, went under, and stood on his hands. When his legs broke water in a shaky but triumphant V, I saw that they were covered with blackish-gray lumps, just like the ones I had seen on Chris's shoulder. They were slugs, big ones. Chris's mouth dropped open, and I felt all the blood in my body go as cold as dry ice. Teddy screamed, his face going pale. Then all three of us were thrashing for the bank, going just as fast as we could. I know more about freshwater slugs now than I did then, but the fact that they are mostly harmless has done nothing to allay the almost insane horror of them I've had ever since that day in the beaver pool. They carry a local anesthetic and an anticoagulant in their alien saliva, which means that the host never feels a thing when they attach themselves. If you don't happen to see them, they'll go on feeding until their swelled, loathsome bodies fall off you, sated, or until they actually burst. We pulled ourselves up on the bank, and Teddy went into a hysterical paroxysm as he looked down at himself. He was screaming as he picked the leeches off his naked body. Vern broke the water and looked at us, puzzled. "What the hell's wrong with leeches?" Teddy screamed, pulling two of them off his trembling thighs and throwing them just as far as he could. "Dirty motherfucking bloodsuckers!" His voice broke shrilly on the last word. "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God," Vern cried. He paddled across the pool and stumbled out. I was still cold. The heat of the day had been suspended. I kept telling myself to catch hold, not to get screaming, not to be a pussy. I picked half a dozen off my arms and several more off my chest. Chris turned his back to me. "Gordy, there any more? Take them off if there are. Please, Gordy." There were more, 5 or 6, running down his back like grotesque black buttons. I pulled their soft, boneless bodies off him. I brushed even more off my legs, then got Chris to do my back. I was starting to relax a little, and that was when I looked down at myself and saw the granddaddy of them all clinging to my testicles, its body swelled to 4 times its normal size. Its blackish-gray skin had gone a bruised, purplish red. That was when I began to lose control. Not outside, at least not in any big way, but inside, where it counts. I brushed its slick, glutinous body with the back of my hand. It held on. I tried to do it again and couldn't bring myself to actually touch it. I turned to Chris, tried to speak, couldn't. I pointed instead. His cheeks, already ashy, went whiter still. "I can't get it off," I said through numb lips. "You... can you..." But he backed away, shaking his head, his mouth twisted. "I can't, Gordy," he said, unable to take his eyes away. "I'm sorry, but I can't. No, oh, no." He turned away, bowed with one hand pressed to his midsection like the butler in a musical comedy, and was sick in a stand of juniper bushes. "You got to hold on to yourself," I thought, looking at the leech that hung off me like a crazy beard. Its body was still visibly swelling. "You got to hold on to yourself and get him. Be tough. It's the last one. The last one." I reached down again and picked it off, and it burst between my fingers. My own blood ran across my palm and inner wrist in a warm flood. I began to cry. Still crying, I walked back to my clothes and put them on. I wanted to stop crying, but I just didn't seem able to turn off the waterworks. Then the shakes set in, making it worse. Vern ran up to me, still naked. "They off, Gordy? They off me? They off me?" He twirled in front of me like an insane dancer on a carnival stage. "They off, huh? Huh? They off me, Gordy?" His eyes kept going past me, as wide and white as the eyes of a plaster horse on a merry-go-round. I nodded that they were and just kept on crying. It seemed that crying was going to be my new career. I tucked my shirt in and then buttoned it all the way to the neck. I put on my socks and my sneakers. Little by little, the tears began to slow down. Finally, there was nothing left but a few hitches and moans, and then they stopped too. Chris walked over to me, wiping his mouth with a handful of elm leaves. His eyes were wide and mute and apologetic. When we were all dressed, we just stood there, looking at each other for a moment. And then we began to climb the railroad embankment. I looked back once at the burst leech lying on top of the tromped-down bushes where we had danced and screamed and grown them off. It looked deflated, but still ominous. 14 years later, I sold my first novel and made my first trip to New York. "It's going to be a 3-day celebration," my new editor told me over the phone. "People slinging bullshit will be summarily shot." But, of course, it was 3 days of unmitigated bullshit. While I was there, I wanted to do all the standard out-of-towner things. See a stage show at the Radio City Music Hall, go to the top of the Empire State Building, fuck the World Trade Center. The building King Kong climbed in 1933 is always going to be the tallest one in the world for me. Visit Times Square by night. Keith, my editor, seemed more than pleased to show his city off. The last touristy thing we did was to take a ride on the Staten Island Ferry. And while leaning on the rail, I happened to look down and see scores of used condoms floating on the mild swells. And I had a moment of almost total recall. Or perhaps it was an actual incidence of time travel. Either way, for one second I was literally in the past, pausing halfway up that embankment and looking back at the burst leech, dead, deflated, but still ominous. Keith must have seen something in my face, because he said, "Not very pretty, are they?" I only shook my head, wanting to tell him not to apologize, wanting to tell him that you didn't have to come to the Apple and ride the ferry to see used rubbers, wanting to say, the only reason anyone writes stories is so they can understand the past and get ready for some future mortality. That's why all the verbs in stories have ED endings, Keith, my good man, even the ones that sell millions of paperbacks. The only two useful art forms are religion and stories. I was pretty drunk that night, as you may have guessed. What I did tell him was, I was thinking of something else, that's all. The most important things are the hardest things to say. 22. We walked further down the tracks. I don't know just how far, and I was starting to think, well, okay, I'm going to be able to handle it. It's all over anyway. Just a bunch of leeches. What the fuck? I was still thinking it when waves of whiteness suddenly began to come over my sight, and I fell down. I must have fallen hard, but landing on the cross ties was like plunging into a warm and puffy feather bed. Someone turned me over. The touch of hands was faint and unimportant. Their faces were disembodied balloons looking down at me from miles up. They looked the way the ref's face must look to a fighter who has been punched silly and is currently taking a 10-second rest on the canvas. Their words came in, gentle oscillations fading in and out. Him? Be all. If you think the sun... Gordy, are you... Then I must have said something that didn't make much sense because they began to look really worried. We'd better take him back, man, Teddy said. And then the whiteness came over everything again. When it cleared, I seemed to be all right. Chris was squatting next to me, saying, "Can you hear me, Gordy? You there, man?" "Yes," I said, and sat up. A swarm of black dots exploded in front of my eyes and then went away. I waited to see if they'd come back, and when they didn't, I stood up. "You scared the cheesy old shit out of me, Gordy," he said. "Do you want a drink of water?" "Yeah." He gave me his canteen, half full of water, and I let three warm gulps roll down my throat. "Why'd you faint, Gordy?" Vern asked anxiously. "Made a bad mistake and looked at your face," I said. "Hee-hee-hee," Teddy cackled. "Fucking Gordy, you wet!" "You really okay?" Vern persisted. "Yeah, sure. It was bad there for a minute, thinking about those suckers." They nodded soberly. We took five in the shade and then went on walking, me and Vern on one side of the tracks again, Chris and Teddy on the other. We figured we must be getting close. 23. We weren't as close as we thought, and if we'd had the brains to spend 2 minutes looking at a road map, we would have seen why. We knew that Ray Brower's corpse had to be near the Back Harlow Road, which dead-ends on the bank of the Royal River. Another trestle carries the GS and WM tracks across the Royal, so this is the way we figured. Once we got close to the Royal, we'd be getting close to the Back Harlow Road, where Billy and Charlie had been parked when they saw the boy. And since the Royal was only 10 miles from Castle River, we figured that we had it made in the shade. But that was 10 miles as the crow flies, and the tracks didn't move on a straight line between the castle and the Royal. Instead, they made a very shallow loop to avoid a hilly, crumbling region called the Bluffs. Anyway, we could have seen that loop quite clearly if we had looked on a map and figured out that instead of 10 miles, we had about 16 to walk. Chris began to suspect the truth when noon had come and gone and the Royal still wasn't in sight. We stopped while he climbed a high pine tree and took a look around. He came down and gave us a simple enough report. It was going to be at least 4 in the afternoon before we got to the Royal, and we would only make it by then if we humped right along. "Ah, shit!" Teddy cried. "So what are we going to do now?" We looked into each other's tired, sweaty faces. We were hungry and out of temper. The big adventure had turned into a long slog, dirty and sometimes scary. We would have been missed back home by now, too, and if Milo Pressman hadn't already called the cops on us, the engineer of the train crossing the trestle might have done it. We had been planning to hitchhike back to Castle Rock, but 4 o'clock was just 3 hours from dark, and nobody gives 4 kids on a backcountry road a lift after dark. I tried to summon up the cool image of my deer, cropping at green morning grass, but even that seemed dusty and no good. No better than a stuffed trophy over the mantel in some guy's hunting lodge, the eyes sprayed to give him that phony, lifelike shine. Finally, Chris said, "It's still closer out going ahead. Let's go." He turned and started to walk along the tracks in his dusty sneakers, head down, his shadow only a puddle at his feet. After a minute or so, the rest of us followed him, strung out in Indian file. 24. In the years between then and the writing of this memoir, I've thought remarkably little about those 2 days in September, at least consciously. The associations the memories bring to the surface are as unpleasant as week-old river corpses brought to the surface by cannon fire. As a result, I never really questioned our decision to walk down the tracks. Put another way, I've wondered sometimes about what we had decided to do, but never how we did it. But now a much simpler scenario comes to mind. I'm confident that if the idea had come up, it would have been shot down. Walking down the tracks would have seemed neater, bosser, as we said then. But if the idea had come up and hadn't been shot down in flames, none of the things which occurred later would have happened. Maybe Chris and Teddy and Vern would even be alive today. No, they didn't die in the woods or on the railroad tracks. Nobody dies in this story except some bloodsuckers and Ray Brower. And if you want to be completely fair about it, he was dead before it even started. But it is true that of the 4 of us who flipped coins to see who would go down to the Florida market to get supplies, only the one who actually went is still alive. The Ancient Mariner at 34, with you, gentle reader, in the role of wedding guest. At this point, shouldn't you flip to the jacket photo to see if my eye holdeth you in its spell? If you sense a certain flipness on my part, you're right. But maybe I have cause. At an age when all 4 of us would be considered too young and immature to be president, 3 of us are dead. And if small events really do echo up larger and larger through time, yes, maybe if we had done the simple thing and simply hitched into Harlow, they would still be alive today. We could have hooked a ride all the way up Route 7 to the Shiloh Church, which stood at the intersection of the highway and the back Harlow Road, at least until 1967, when it was leveled by a fire attributed to a tramp's smoldering cigarette butt. With reasonable luck, we could have gotten to where the body was by sundown of the previous day. But the idea wouldn't have lived. It wouldn't have been shot down with tightly buttressed arguments and debating society rhetoric, but with grunts and scowls and farts and raised middle fingers. The verbal part of the discussion would have been carried forward with such trenchant and sparkling contributions as, "Fuck no!" and "That sucks!" and that old reliable standby, "Did your mother have any kids that lived?" Unspoken, maybe it was too fundamental to be spoken, was the idea that this was a big thing. It wasn't screwing around with firecrackers or trying to look through the knothole in the back of the girl's privy at Harrison State Park. This was something on a par with getting laid for the first time, or going into the army, or buying your first bottle of legal liquor, just bopping into that state store if you can dig it, selecting a bottle of good scotch, showing the clerk your draft card and driver's license, then walking out with a grin on your face and that brown bag in your hand, member of a club with just a few more rights and privileges than our old treehouse with a tin roof. There's a high ritual to all fundamental events. The rites of passage, the magic corridor where the change happens, buying the condoms, standing before the minister, raising your hand and taking the oath, or, if you please, walking down the railroad tracks to meet a fellow your own age halfway, the same as I'd walk halfway over to Pine Street to meet Chris if he was coming over to my house, or the way Teddy would walk halfway down Gate Street to meet me if I was going to his. It seemed right to do it this way, because the rite of passage is a magic corridor, and so we always provide an aisle. It's what you walk down when you get married, what they carry you down when you get buried. Our corridor was those twin rails, and we walked between them, just hopping along toward whatever this was supposed to mean. You don't hitchhike your way to a thing like that, maybe. And maybe we thought it was also right that it should have turned out to be harder than we had expected. Events surrounding our hike had turned it into what we had suspected it was all along. Serious business. What we didn't know as we walked around the bluffs was that Billy Tessio, Charlie Hogan, Jack Mudgett, Norman Fuzzy Brackowitz, Vince Desjardins, Chris's older brother Eyeball, and Ace Merrill himself were all on their way to take a look at the body themselves. In a weird kind of way, Ray Brower had become famous, and our secret had turned into a regular road show. They were piling into Ace's chopped and channeled 52 Ford and Vince's pink 54 Studebaker even as we started on the last leg of our trip. Billy and Charlie had managed to keep their enormous secret for just about 36 hours. Then Charlie spilled it to Ace while they were shooting pool, and Billy had spilled it to Jack Mudgett while they were fishing for steelies from the Boom Road Bridge. Both Ace and Jack had sworn solemnly on their mother's names to keep the secret, and that was how everybody in their gang knew about it by noon. Guess you could tell what those assholes thought about their mothers. They all congregated down at the pool hall, and Fuzzy Brackowitz advanced a theory, which you have heard before, gentle reader, that they could all become heroes, not to mention instant radio and TV personalities, by discovering the body. All they had to do, Fuzzy maintained, was to take two cars with a lot of fishing gear in the trunks. After they found the body, their story would be 100%. We were just planning to take a few pickerel out of the Royal River, officer. Look what we found. They were burning up the road from Castle Rock to the back Harlow area just as we started to finally get close. 25. Clouds began to build in the sky around 2 o'clock, but at first none of us took them seriously. It hadn't rained since the early days of July, so why should it rain now? But they kept building to the south of us, up and up and up, thunderheads in great pillars as purple as bruises, and they began to move slowly our way. I looked at them closely, checking for that membrane beneath that means it's already raining 20 miles away or 50. But there was no rain yet. The clouds were still just building. Vern got a blister on his heel, and we stopped and rested while he packed the back of his left sneaker with moss stripped from the bark of an old oak tree. "Is it going to rain, Gordy?" Teddy asked. "I think so." "Pisser," he said, and sighed. "That pisser good end to a pisser good day." I laughed, and he tipped me a wink. We started to walk again, a little more slowly now, out of respect for Vern's hurt foot. And in the hour between 2 and 3, the quality of the day's light began to change, and we knew for sure that rain was coming. It was just as hot as ever, and even more humid, but we knew. And the birds did. They seemed to appear from nowhere and swoop across the sky, chattering and crying shrilly to each other. And the light, from a steady beating brightness, it seemed to evolve into something filtered, almost pearly. Our shadows, which had begun to grow long again, also grew fuzzy and ill-defined. The sun had begun to sail in and out through the thickening decks of clouds, and the southern sky had gone a coppery shade. We watched the thunderheads lumber closer, fascinated by their size and their mute threat. Every now and then it seemed that a giant flash bulb had gone off inside one of them, turning their purplish, bruised color momentarily to a light gray. I saw a jagged fork of lightning lick down from the underside of the closest. It was bright enough to print a blue tattoo on my retinas. It was followed by a long, shaking blast of thunder. We did a little bitching about how we were going to get caught out in the rain, but only because it was the expected thing. Of course, we were all looking forward to it. It would be cold and refreshing and leech-free. At a little past 3:30, we saw running water through a break in the trees. "That's it!" Chris yelled jubilantly. "That's the Royal! We began to walk faster, taking our second wind. The storm was getting close now. The air began to stir, and it seemed that the temperature dropped 10 degrees in the space of seconds. I looked down and saw that my shadow had disappeared entirely. We were walking in pairs again, each two watching a side of the railroad embankment. My mouth was dry, throbbing with a sickish tension. The sun sailed behind another cloud bank, and this time it didn't come back out. For a moment, the bank's edges were embroidered with gold, like a cloud in an Old Testament Bible illustration, and then the wine-colored, dragging belly of the thunder had blotted out all traces of the sun. The day became gloomy. The clouds were rapidly eating up the last of the blue. We could smell the river so clearly that we might have been horses, or perhaps it was the smell of rain impending in the air as well. There was an ocean above us, held in by a thin sack that might rupture and let down a flood at any second. I kept trying to look into the underbrush, but my eyes were continually drawn back to that turbulent, racing sky. In its deepening colors you could read whatever doom you liked, water, fire, wind, hail. The cool breeze became more insistent, hissing in the firs. A sudden, impossible bolt of lightning flashed down, seemingly from directly overhead, making me cry out and clap my hands to my eyes. God had taken my picture, a little kid with his shirt tied around his waist, duck bumps on his bare chest and cinders on his cheeks. I heard the rending fall of some big tree not 60 yards away. The crack of thunder which followed made me cringe. I wanted to be at home, reading a good book in a safe place, like down in the potato cellar. "Jesus!" Vern screamed in a high, fainting voice. "Oh, my Jesus Christ, look at that!" I looked in the direction Vern was pointing and saw a blue-white fireball bowling its way up the left-hand rail of the GS and WM tracks, crackling and hissing for all the world like a scalded cat. It hurried past us as we turned to watch it go, dumbfounded, aware for the first time that such things could exist. 20 feet beyond us, it made a sudden pop and just disappeared, leaving a greasy smell of ozone behind. "What am I doing here anyway?" Teddy muttered. "What a pisser!" Chris exclaimed happily, his face upturned. "This is gonna be a pisser like you wouldn't believe!" But I was with Teddy. Looking up at that sky gave me a dismaying sense of vertigo. It was more like looking into some deeply mysterious marbled gorge. Another lightning bolt crashed down, making us duck. This time the ozone smell was hotter, more urgent. The following clap of thunder came with no perceptible pause at all. My ears were still ringing from it when Vern began to screech triumphantly, "There! There he is! Right there, I see him!" I can see Vern right this minute if I want to. All I have to do is sit back for a minute and close my eyes. He's standing there, on the left-hand rail like an explorer on the prow of his ship, one hand shielding his eyes from the silver stroke of lightning that has just come down, the other extended and pointing. We ran up beside him and looked. I was thinking to myself, Vern's imagination just ran away with him, that's all. The suckers, the heat, now this storm. His eyes are dealing wild cards, that's all. But that wasn't what it was, although there was a split second when I wanted it to be. In that split second, I knew I never wanted to see a corpse, not even a run-over woodchuck. In the place where we were standing, early spring rains had washed part of the embankment away, leaving a gravelly, uncertain 4-foot drop-off. The railroad maintenance crews had either not yet gotten around to it in their yellow diesel-operated repair carts, or it had happened so recently it hadn't yet been reported. At the bottom of this washout was a marshy, mucky tangle of undergrowth that smelled bad, and sticking out of a wild clockspring of blackberry brambles was a single, pale, white hand. Did any of us breathe? I didn't. The breeze was now a wind, harsh and jerky, coming at us from no particular direction, jumping and whirling, slapping at our sweaty skins and open pores. I hardly noticed. I think part of my mind was waiting for Teddy to cry out, "Paratroops over the side," and I thought if he did that, I might just go crazy. It would have been better to see the whole body, all at once, but instead there was only that limp, outstretched hand, horribly white, the fingers limply splayed, like the hand of a drowned boy. It told us the truth of the whole matter. It explained every graveyard in the world. The image of that hand came back to me every time I heard or read of an atrocity. Somewhere attached to that hand was the rest of Ray Brower. Lightning flickered and stroked. Thunder ripped in behind each stroke as if a drag race had started over our heads. "She," Chris said. The sound not quite a cuss word, not quite the country version of shit as it is pronounced around a slender stem of timothy grass when the baler breaks down. Instead, it was a long, tuneless syllable without meaning, a sigh that had just happened to pass through the vocal cords. Vern was licking his lips in a compulsive sort of way as if he had tasted some obscure new delicacy, a Howard Johnson's 29th flavor, Tibetan sausage rolls, interstellar escargot, something so weird that it excited and revolted him at the same time. Teddy only stood and looked. The wind whipped his greasy, clotted hair first away from his ears and then back over them. His face was a total blank. I could tell you I saw something there, and perhaps I did in hindsight, but not then. There were black ants trundling back and forth across the hand. A great whispering noise began to rise in the woods on either side of the tracks, as if the forest had just noticed we were there and was commenting on it. The rain had started. Dime-sized drops fell on my head and arms. They struck the embankment, turning the fill dark for a moment, and then the color changed back again as the greedy, dry ground sucked the moisture up. Those big drops fell for maybe 5 seconds, and then they stopped. I looked at Chris, and he blinked back at me. Then the storm came, all at once, as if a shower chain had been pulled in the sky. The whispering sound changed to loud contention. It was as if we were being rebuked for our discovery, and it was frightening. Nobody tells you about the pathetic fallacy until you're in college, and even then I noticed that nobody but the total dorks completely believed it was a fallacy. Chris jumped over the side of the washout, his hair already soaked and clinging to his head. I followed. Vern and Teddy came close behind, but Chris and I were the first to reach the body of Ray Brower. He was face down. Chris looked into my eyes, his face set and stern. An adult's face. I nodded slightly, as if he had spoken aloud. I think he was down here, and relatively intact, instead of up there between the rails and completely mangled, because he was trying to get out of the way when the train hit him, knocking him head over heels. He had landed with his head pointed toward the tracks, arms over his head like a diver about to execute. He had landed in this boggy cup of land that was becoming a small swamp. His hair was a dark reddish color. The moisture in the air had made it curl slightly at the ends. There was blood in it, but not a great deal, not a gross-out amount. The ants were grosser. He was wearing a solid-colored dark green T-shirt and blue jeans. His feet were bare, and a few feet behind him, caught in tall blackberry brambles, I saw a pair of filthy, low-topped keds. For a moment I was puzzled. Why was he here and his tennies there? Then I realized, and the realization was like a dirty punch below the belt. My wife, my kids, my friends, they all think that having an imagination like mine must be quite nice. Aside from making all this dough, I can have a little mind movie whenever things get dull. Mostly they're right, but every now and then it turns around and bites the shit out of you with these long teeth. Teeth that have been filed to points like the teeth of a cannibal. You see things you just as soon not see. Things that keep you awake until first light. I saw one of those things now, saw it with absolute clarity and certainty. He had been knocked spang out of his keds. The train had knocked him out of his keds just as it had knocked the life out of his body. That finally rammed it all the way home for me. The kid was dead. The kid wasn't sick. The kid wasn't sleeping. The kid wasn't going to get up in the morning anymore, or get the runs from eating too many apples, or catch poison ivy, or wear out the eraser on the end of his Ticonderoga number 2 during a hard math test. The kid was dead. Stone dead. The kid was never going to go out bottling with his friends in the spring, gunny sack over his shoulder to pick up the returnables of retreating snow uncovered. The kid wasn't going to wake up at 2 a.m. on the morning of November 1st this year, run to the bathroom, and vomit up a big glurt of cheap Halloween candy. The kid wasn't going to pull a single girl's braid in home room. The kid wasn't going to give a bloody nose or get one. The kid was can't, don't, won't, never, shouldn't, wouldn't, couldn't. He was the side of the battery where the terminal says neg, the fuse you have to put a penny in, the wastebasket by the teacher's desk which always smells of wood shavings from the sharpener and dead orange peels from lunch, the haunted house outside of town where the windows are crashed out, the no trespassing signs whipped away across the fields, the attic full of bats, the cellar full of rats. The kid was dead, mister, ma'am, young sir, little miss. I could go on all day and never get it right about the distance between his bare feet on the ground and his dirty keds hanging in the bushes. It was 30-plus inches. It was a Google of light years. The kid was disconnected from his kids beyond all hope of reconciliation. He was dead. We turned him face up into the pouring rain, the lightning, the steady crack of thunder. There were ants and bugs all over his face and neck. They ran briskly in and out of the round collar of his t-shirt. His eyes were open, but terrifyingly out of sync. One was rolled back so far that we could only see a tiny arc of iris. The other stared straight up into the storm. There was a dried froth of blood above his mouth and on his chin, from a bloody nose, I thought, and the right side of his face was lacerated and darkly bruised. Still, I thought, he didn't really look bad. I had once walked into a door my brother Dennis was shoving open, came off with bruises even worse than this kid's, plus the bloody nose, and still had two helpings of everything for supper after it happened. Teddy and Vern stood behind us, and if there had been any sight at all left in that one upward staring eye, I suppose we would have looked to Ray Brower like pallbearers in a horror movie. A beetle came out of his mouth, trekked across his fuzzless cheek, stepped onto a nettle, and was gone. "Do you see that?" Teddy asked in a high, strange, fainting voice. "I bet he's fucking full of bugs. I bet his brain's re—" "Shut up, Teddy," Chris said, and Teddy did, looking relieved. Lightning forked blue across the sky, making the boy's single eye light up. You could almost believe he was glad to be found, and found by boys his own age. His torso had swelled up, and there was a faint, gassy odor about him, like the smell of old farts. I turned away, sure I was going to be sick, but my stomach was dry, hard, steady. I suddenly rammed two fingers down my throat, trying to make myself heave, needing to do it, as if I could sick it up and get rid of it. But my stomach only hitched a little and then was steady again. The roaring downpour and the accompanying thunder had completely covered the sound of cars approaching along the back Harlow Road, which lay bare yards beyond this boggy tangle. It likewise covered the crackle crunch of the underbrush as they blundered through it from the dead end where they had parked. And the first we knew of them was Ace Merrill's voice, raised above the tumult of the storm, saying, "Well, what the fuck do you know about this?" 26. We all jumped like we had been goosed, and Vern cried out. He admitted later that he thought for just a second that the voice had come from the dead boy. On the far side of the boggy patch, where the woods took up again, masking the butt end of the road, Ace Merrill and Eyeball Chambers stood together, half obscured by a pouring gray curtain of rain. They were both wearing red nylon high school jackets, the kind you can buy in the office if you're a regular student, the same kind they give away free to varsity sports players. Their DA haircuts had been plastered back against their skulls, and a mixture of rainwater and Vitalis ran down their cheeks like ersatz tears. "Some bitch," Eyeball said. "That's my little brother." Chris was staring at Eyeball with his mouth open. His shirt, wet, limp, and dark, was still tied around his skinny middle. His pack, stained a darker green by the rain, was hanging against his naked shoulder blades. "You get away, Rich," he said in a trembling voice. "We found him. We got dibs." "Fuck your dibs. We're going to report him." "No, you're not," I said. I was suddenly furious with them, turning up this way at the last minute. If we'd thought about it, we'd have known something like this was going to happen. But this was one time, somehow, that the older, bigger kids weren't going to steal it. To take something away they wanted, as if by divine right, as if their easy way was the right way, the only way. They had come in cars. I think that was what made me angriest. They had come in cars. There's four of us, Eyeball. You just try. Oh, we'll try. Don't worry, Eyeball said, and the trees shook behind him and Ace. Charlie Hogan and Vern's brother Billy stepped through them, cursing and wiping water out of their eyes. I felt a lead ball drop into my belly. It grew bigger as Jack Mudgett, Fuzzy Brackowitz, and Vince Desjardins stepped out behind Charlie and Billy. Here we all are, Ace said, grinning. So you just... Vern! Billy Tessio cried in a terrible accusing, my judgment cometh in that right early voice. He made a pair of dripping fists. You little son of a whore. You was under the porch, cockknocker. Vern flinched. Charlie Hogan waxed positively lyrical. You little keyhole-peeping, cunt-linking bungwipe. I ought to beat the living shit out of you. Yeah? Well, try it. Teddy brayed suddenly. His eyes were crazily alight behind his rain-spotted glasses. Come on, fight you for him. Come on. Come on, big men. Billy and Charlie didn't need a second invitation. They started forward together, and Vern flinched again, no doubt visualizing the ghosts of beatings past and beatings yet to come. He flinched, but hung tough. He was with his friends, and we had been through a lot, and we hadn't got here in a couple of cars. But Ace held Billy and Charlie back, simply by touching each of them on the shoulder. Now, listen, you guys, Ace said. He spoke patiently, just as if we weren't all standing in a roaring rainstorm. There's more of us here than there are of you. We're bigger. We'll give you one chance to just blow away. I don't give a fuck where. Just make like a tree and leave. Chris's brother giggled, and Fuzzy clapped Ace on the back in appreciation of his great wit, the Sid Caesar of the J.D. set. "'Cause we're taking him,' Ace smiled gently, and you could imagine him smiling that same gentle smile just before breaking his cue over the head of some uneducated punk who had made the terrible mistake of lipping off while Ace was lining up a shot. "'If you go, we'll take him. If you stay, we'll beat the piss out of you and still take him. Besides,' he added, trying to gild the thuggery with a little righteousness, "'Charlie and Billy found him, so it's their dibs anyway.' "'They was chicken,' Teddy shot back. "'Vern told us about it. They was fucking chicken right out of their fucking minds.' He screwed up his face into a terrified, sniveling parody of Charlie Hogan. "'I wish we never boosted that car. I wish we never went out on old back Harlow Road to whack off a piece. Oh, Billy, what are we gonna do?' Oh, Billy, I think I just turned my Fruit of the Looms into a fudge factory. Oh, Billy! That's it, Charlie said, starting forward again. His face was knotted with rage and sullen embarrassment. Kid, whatever your name is, get ready to reach down your fucking throat the next time you need to pick your nose.
I looked wildly down at Ray Brower. He stared calmly up into the rain with his one eye, below us but above it all. The thunder was still booming steadily, but the rain had begun to slack off.
"'What do you say, Gordy?' Ace asked.
He was holding Charlie lightly by the arm, the way an accomplished trainer would restrain a vicious dog. "'You must have at least some of your brother's sense. Tell these guys to back off. I'll let Charlie beat up the Four Eyes El Punko a little bit, and then we'll all go about our business. What do you say?'
He was wrong to mention Denny. I had wanted to reason with him, to point out what Ace knew perfectly well, that we had every right to take Billy and Charlie's dibs, since Vern had heard them giving said dibs away. I wanted to tell him how Vern and I had almost gotten run down by a freight train on the trestle which spans the Castle River, about Milo Pressman and his fearless, if stupid, sidekick Chopper the Wonder Dog, about the Bloodsuckers, too. I guess all I really wanted to tell him was, come on, Ace, fair is fair. You know that. But he had to bring Denny into it. And what I heard coming out of my mouth instead of sweet reason was my own death warrant. Suck my fat one, you cheap dime store hood.
Ace's mouth formed the perfect O of surprise. The expression was so unexpectedly prissy that under other circumstances it would have been a laugh riot, so to speak. All of the others on both sides of the bog stared at me. Dumbfounded. Then Teddy screamed gleefully,
That's telling him, Gordy! Oh, boy, too cool!
I stood numbly, unable to believe it. It was like some crazed understudy had shot on stage at the critical moment and declaimed lines that weren't even in the play.
Telling a guy to suck was as bad as you could get without resorting to his mother. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw that Chris had unshouldered his knapsack and was digging into it frantically. But I didn't get it. Not then, anyway. "Okay," Ace said softly. "Let's take him. Don't hurt nobody but the LaChance kid. I'm gonna break both his fucking arms." I went dead cold. I didn't piss myself the way I had on the railroad trestle, but it must have been because I had nothing inside to let out. He meant it, you see. The years between then and now have changed my mind about a lot of things, but not about that. When Ace said he was going to break both of my arms, he absolutely meant it. They started to walk toward us, through the slackening rain. Jackie Mudgett took a switch knife out of his pocket and hit the chrome. 6 inches of steel flicked out, dove gray in the afternoon half-light. Vern and Teddy dropped suddenly into fighting crouches on either side of me. Teddy did so eagerly, Vern with a desperate, cornered grimace on his face. The big kids advanced in a line, their feet splashing through the bog, which was now one big, sludgy puddle because of the storm. The body of Ray Brower lay at our feet like a waterlogged barrel. I got ready to fight. And that was when Chris fired the pistol he had hawked out of his old man's dresser. Kablam! God, what a wonderful sound that was. Charlie Hogan jumped right up into the air. Ace Merrill, who had been staring straight at me, now jerked around and looked at Chris. His mouth made that O again. Eyeball looked absolutely astounded. "Hey, Chris, that's Daddy's," he said. "You're gonna get that tar whaled out of you? That's nothing to what you'll get," Chris said. His face was horribly pale, and all the life in him seemed to have been sucked upward into his eyes. They blazed out of his face. "Gordy was right. You're nothing but a bunch of cheap hoods. Charlie and Billy didn't want their fucking dibs, and you all know it. We wouldn't have walked way the fuck out here if they said they did. They just went someplace and puked the story up and let Ace Merrill do their thinking for 'em." His voice rose to a scream. "But you ain't gonna get 'em. Do you hear me?" "Now listen," Ace said. "You better put that down before you take your foot off with it. You ain't got the sack to shoot a woodchuck." He began to walk forward again, smiling his gentle smile as he came. "You're just a sawed-off, pint-sized, pissy-assed little runt, and I'm gonna make you eat that fucking gun. Ace, if you don't stand still, I'm going to shoot you. I swear to God." "You'll go to jail," Ace crooned, not even hesitating. He was still smiling. The others watched him with horrified fascination, much the same way as Teddy and Vern and I were looking at Chris. Ace Merrill was the hardest case for miles around, and I didn't think Chris could bluff him down. And what did that leave? Ace didn't think a 12-year-old punk would actually shoot him. I thought he was wrong. I thought Chris would shoot Ace before he'd let Ace take his father's pistol away from him. In those few seconds, I was sure there was going to be bad trouble. The worst I'd ever known. Killing trouble, maybe. And all of it over who got dibs on a dead body. Chris said softly, with great regret, "Where do you want it, Ace? Arm or leg? I can't pick. You pick for me." And Ace stopped. XXVII. His face sagged, and I saw sudden terror on it. It was Chris's tone rather than his actual words, I think. The real regret that things were going to go from bad to worse. If it was a bluff, it's still the best I've ever seen. The other big kids were totally convinced. Their faces were squinched up as if someone had just touched a match to a cherry bomb with a short fuse. Ace slowly got control of himself. The muscles in his face tightened again, his lips pressed together, and he looked at Chris the way you'd look at a man who has made a serious business proposition, to merge with your company, or handle your line of credit, or shoot your balls off. It was a waiting, almost curious expression, one that made you know that the terror was either gone or tightly lidded. Ace had recomputed the odds on not getting shot, and had decided that they weren't as much in his favor as he had thought. But he was still dangerous, maybe more than before. Since then, I've thought it was the rawest piece of brinkmanship I've ever seen. Neither of them was bluffing. They both meant business. "All right," Ace said softly, speaking to Chris. But I know how you're going to come out of this, motherfuck. No, you don't, Chris said.
You little prick, Eyeball said loudly. You're going to wind up in traction for this. Bite my bag, Chris told him.
With an inarticulate sound of rage, Eyeball started forward and Chris put a bullet into the water about 10 feet in front of him. It kicked up a splash. Eyeball jumped back, cursing.
Okay, now what? Hayes asked.
Now you guys get into your cars and bomb on back to Castle Rock. After that, I don't care, but you ain't getting him.
He touched Ray Brower lightly, almost reverently, with the toe of one sopping sneaker.
You dig me?
But we'll get you, Ace said. He was starting to smile again. Don't you know that?
You might not.
We'll get you hard, Ace said, smiling. We'll hurt you.
I can't believe you don't know that. We'll put you all in the fucking hospital with fucking ruptures.
Sincerely.
Oh, why don't you go home and fuck your mother some more? I hear she loves the way you do it.
Ace's smile froze.
I'll kill you for that. Nobody ranks my mother.
I heard your mother fucks for bucks, Chris informed him. And as Ace began to pale, as his complexion began to approach Chris's own ghastly whiteness, he added,
In fact, I heard she throws blowjobs for jukebox nickels. I heard...
Then the storm came back, viciously, all at once. Only this time it was hail instead of rain. Instead of whispering or talking, the woods now seemed alive with hokey B-movie jungle drums. It was the sound of big, icy hailstones bonking off tree trunks. Stinging pebbles began to hit my shoulders. It felt as if some sentient, malevolent force were throwing them. Worse than that, they began to strike Ray Brower's upturned face with an awful splatting sound that reminded us of him again, of his terrible and unending patience. Vern caved in first with a wailing scream. He fled up the embankment in huge, gangling strides. Teddy held out a minute longer, then ran after Vern, his hands held up over his head. On their side, Vince Desjardins floundered back under some nearby trees and Fuzzy Brackowitz joined him, but the others stood pat, and Ace began to grin again.
Stick with me, Gordy, Chris said in a low, shaky voice. Stick with me, man. I'm right here.
Go on now, Chris said to Ace, and he was able by some magic to get the shakiness out of his voice. He sounded as if he were instructing a stupid infant.
We'll get you. Ace said. We're not going to forget it, if that's what you're thinking. This is big time, baby.
That's fine. You just go on and do your getting another day.
We'll fucking ambush you, Chambers. We'll...
Get out! Chris screamed and leveled the gun. Ace stepped back. He looked at Chris a moment longer, nodded, then turned around.
Come on, he said to the others.
He looked back over his shoulder at Chris and me once more.
Be seeing you.
They went back into the screen of trees between the bog and the road. Chris and I stood perfectly still, in spite of the hail that was welting us, reddening our skins, and piling up all around us like summer snow. We stood and listened, and above the crazy calypso sound of the hail hitting the tree trunks, we heard the two cars start up.
Stay right here, Chris told me,
and then he started across the bog.
Chris, I said, panicky.
I got to. Stay here. It seemed he was gone a very long time. I became convinced that either Ace or Eyeball had lurked behind and grabbed him. I stood my ground with nobody but Ray Brower for company and waited for somebody, anybody, to come back. After a while, Chris did.
We did it, he said. They're gone.
You sure?
Yeah, both cars.
He held his hands up over his head, locked together with the gun between them, and shook the double fist in a wry championship gesture. Then he dropped them and smiled at me. I think it was the saddest, scaredest smile I ever saw.
Suck my fat one. Whoever told you you had a fat one, LaChance?
Biggest one in 4 counties, I said. I was shaking all over. We looked at each other warmly for a second, and then, maybe embarrassed by what we were seeing, looked down together.
A nasty thrill of fear shot through me, and the sudden splash, splash, as Chris shifted his feet, let me know that he had seen too.
Ray Brower's eyes had gone wide and white, starry and pupil-less, like the eyes that look out at you from a Grecian statuary.
It only took a second to understand what had happened, but understanding didn't lessen the horror. His eyes had filled up with round, white hailstones. Now they were melting, and the water ran down his cheeks as if he were weeping for his own grotesque position, a tatty prize to be fought over by two bunches of stupid hick kids. His clothes were also white with hail. He seemed to be lying in his own shroud. "Oh, Gordy, hey," Chris said shakily. "Say, hey, man, what a creep show for him. I don't think he knows. Maybe that was his ghost we heard. Maybe he knew this was going to happen. What a fucking creep show. I'm sincere." Branches crackled behind us. I whirled. Sure, they had flanked us, but Chris went back to contemplating the body after one short, almost casual glance. It was Vern and Teddy. Their jeans soaked black and plastered to their legs, both of them grinning like dogs that have been sucking eggs. "What are we going to do, man?" Chris asked. And I felt a weird chill steal through me. Maybe he was talking to me, maybe he was. But he was still looking down at the body. "We're going to take him back, ain't we?" Teddy asked, puzzled. "We're going to be heroes, ain't that right?" He looked from Chris to me and back to Chris again. Chris looked up, as if startled out of a dream. His lip curled. He took big steps toward Teddy, planted both hands on Teddy's chest, and pushed him roughly backwards. Teddy stumbled, pinwheeled his arms for balance, then sat down with a soggy splash. He blinked up at Chris like a surprised muskrat. Vern was looking warily at Chris as if he feared madness. Perhaps that wasn't far from the mark. "You keep your trap shut," Chris said to Teddy. "Paratroops over the side, my ass, you lousy rubber chicken."
"It was the hail!" Teddy cried out, angry and ashamed. "It wasn't those guys, Chris. I'm as scared of storms. I can't help it. I would have taken all of them on at once. I swear on my mother's name, but I'm as scared of storms. Shit, I can't help it."
He began to cry again, sitting there in the water. "What about you?" Chris asked, turning to Vern. "Are you scared of storms, too?" Vern shook his head vacuously, still astounded by Chris's rage.
"Hey, man, I thought we was all running."
"You must be a mind reader, then, because you ran first." Vern swallowed twice and said nothing. Chris stared at him, his eyes sullen and wild. Then he turned to me. "Going to build him a litter, Gordy." "If you say so, Chris."
"Sure, like in Scouts."
His voice had begun to climb into strange, reedy levels.
"Just like in the fucking Scouts. A litter, poles and shirts, like in the handbook, right, Gordy?"
"Yeah, if you want. But what if those guys..."
"Fuck those guys!" he screamed. "You're all a bunch of chickens. Fuck off, creeps!"
"Chris, they could call the constable to get back at us.
He's ours, and we're going to take him out."
"Those guys would say anything to get us in Dutch," I told him. My words sounded thin, stupid, sick with the flu.
"Say anything and then lie each other up. You know how people can get each other in trouble telling lies, man, like with the milk money."
"I don't care," he screamed, and lunged at me with his fists up. But one of his feet struck Ray Brower's ribcage with a soggy thump, making the body rock. He tripped and fell full length, and I waited for him to get up and maybe punch me in the mouth. But instead he lay where he had fallen, head pointing toward the embankment, arms stretched out over his head like a diver about to execute, in the exact posture Ray Brower had been in when we found him. I looked wildly at Chris's feet to make sure his sneakers were still on. Then he began to cry and scream, his body bucking in the muddy water, splashing it around, fists drumming up and down in it, head twisting from side to side. Teddy and Vern were staring at him, agog, because nobody had ever seen Chris Chambers cry. After a moment or two, I walked back to the embankment, climbed it, and sat down on one of the rails. Teddy and Vern followed me, and we sat there in the rain, not talking, looking like those three monkeys of virtue they sell in dime stores and those sleazy gift shops that always look like they are tottering on the edge of bankruptcy. 28. It was 20 minutes before Chris climbed the embankment to sit down beside us. The clouds had begun to break. Spears of sun came down through the rips. The bushes seemed to have gone 3 shades darker green in the last 45 minutes. He was mud all the way up one side and down the other. His hair was standing up in muddy spikes. The only clean parts of him were the whitewashed circles around his eyes. "You're right, Gordy," he said. "Nobody gets last dibs. Gucci all around, huh? I nodded. 5 minutes passed. No one said anything. And then I happened to have a thought, just in case they did call Bannerman. I went back down the embankment and over to where Chris had been standing. I got down on my knees and began to comb carefully through the water and the marsh grass with my fingers. "What are you doing?" Teddy asked, joining me. "It's to your left, I think," Chris said, and pointed. I looked there, and after a minute or two, I found both shell casings. They winked in the fresh sunlight. I gave them to Chris. He nodded and stuffed them into a pocket of his jeans. "Now we go," Chris said.
"Hey, come on," Teddy yelled in real agony. "I want to take him."
"Listen, dummy," Chris said. "If we take him back, we could all wind up in the reformatory. It's like Gordy says. Those guys could make up any story they wanted to. What if they said we killed him, huh? How would you like that?"
"I don't give a damn," Teddy said sulkily.
Then he looked at us with absurd hope.
"Besides, we might only get a couple of months or so. As accessories, I mean. We're only 12 fucking years old. They ain't gonna put us in Shawshank."
Chris said softly, "You can't get in the army if you got a record, Teddy." I was pretty sure that was nothing but a bald-faced lie, but somehow this didn't seem the time to say so. Teddy just looked at Chris for a long time, his mouth trembling. Finally, he managed to squeak out, "No shit? Ask Gordy." He looked at me hopefully. "He's right," I said, feeling like a great big turd. "He's right, Teddy. First thing they do when you volunteer is to check your name through R&I.
"Holy God!"
"We're going to shag ass back to the trestle," Chris said. "Then we'll get off the tracks and come into Castle Rock from the other direction. If people ask us where we were, we'll say we went camping up on Brickyard Hill and got lost." "Milo Pressman knows better," I said. "That creep at the Florida Market does, too." "Well, we'll say Milo scared us, and that's when we decided to go up on the Brickyard." I nodded. "That might work. If Vern and Teddy could remember to stick to it."
"What about if our folks get together?" Vern asked.
"You worry about it if you want," Chris said. "My dad'll still be juiced up."
"Come on, then," Vern said,
eyeing the screen of trees between us and the back Harlow Road. He looked like he expected Bannerman, along with a brace of bloodhounds, to come crashing through at any moment. "Let's get while the getting's good." We were all on our feet now, ready to go. The birds were singing like crazy, pleased with the rain and the shine and the worms and just about everything in the world, I guess. We all turned around as if pulled on strings and looked back at Ray Brower. He was lying there, alone again. His arms had flopped out when we turned him over, and now he was sort of spread-eagled, as if to welcome the sunshine. For a moment it seemed all right, a more natural death scene than any ever constructed for a viewing room audience by a mortician. Then you saw the bruise, the caked blood on the chin and under the nose, and the way the corpse was beginning to bloat. You saw that the blue bottles had come out with the sun, and that they were circling the body, buzzing indolently. You remembered that gassy smell, sickish but dry, like farts in a closed room. He was a boy our age. He was dead, and I rejected the idea that anything about it could be natural. I pushed it away with horror. "Okay," Chris said, and he meant to be brisk, but his voice came out of his throat like a handful of dry bristles from an old whisk broom. "Double time." We started to almost trot back the way we had come. We didn't talk. I don't know about the others, but I was too busy thinking to talk. There were things that bothered me about the body of Ray Brower. They bothered me then, and they bother me now. A bad bruise on the side of his face. A scalp laceration. A bloody nose. No more. At least no more visible. People walk away from bar fights in worse condition and go right on drinking. Yet the train must have hit him. Why else would his sneakers be off his feet that way? And how come the engineer hadn't seen him? Could it be that the train had hit him hard enough to toss him but not to kill him? I thought that under just the right combination of circumstances, that could have happened. Had the train hit him a hefty, teeth-rattling sideswipe as he tried to get out of the way? Hit him and knocked him in a flying, backward somersault over that caved-in banking? Had he perhaps lain awake and trembling in the dark for hours? Not just lost now, but disoriented as well, cut off from the world. Maybe he had died of fear. A bird with crushed tail feathers once died in my cupped hands in just that way. Its body trembled and vibrated lightly. Its beak opened and closed. Its dark, bright eyes stared up at me. Then the vibration quit. The beak froze, half open, and the black eyes became lackluster and uncaring. It could have been that way with Ray Brower. He could have died because he was simply too frightened to go on living. But there was another thing, and that bothered me most of all, I think. He had started off to go burying. I seem to remember the news report saying he had been carrying a pot to put his berries in. When we got back, I went to the library and looked it up in the newspapers just to be sure, and I was right. He'd been burying, and he'd had a pail or a pot, something like that. But we hadn't found it. We found him, and we found his sneakers. He must have thrown it away somewhere between Chamberlain and the boggy patch of ground in Harlow where he died. He perhaps clutched it even tighter at first, as though it linked him to home and safety. But as his fear grew, and with it that sense of being utterly alone, with no chance of rescue except for whatever he could do by himself, as the real cold terror set in, he maybe threw it away into the woods on one side of the tracks or the other, hardly even noticing it was gone. I've thought of going back and looking for it. How does that strike you for morbid? I've thought of driving to the end of the back Harlow Road in my almost new Ford van and getting out of it some bright summer morning all by myself, my wife and children far off in another world where, if you turn a switch, lights come on in the dark. I've thought about how it would be. Pulling my pack out of the back and resting it on the customized van's rear bumper while I carefully remove my shirt and tie it around my waist. Rubbing my chest and shoulders with muskall insect repellent, and then crashing through the woods to where that boggy place was, the place where we found him. Would the grass grow up yellow there in the shape of his body? Of course not, there would be no sign, but still you wonder, and you realize what a thin film there is between your rational man costume, the writer with leather elbow patches on his corduroy jacket, and the capering Gorgon myths of childhood. Then climbing the embankment, now overgrown with weeds, and walking slowly beside the rusted tracks and rotted ties toward Chamberlain. Stupid fantasy. An expedition looking for a 20-year-old blueberry bucket, which was probably cast deep into the woods, or plowed under by a bulldozer readying a half-acre plot for a tract house, or so deeply overgrown by weeds and brambles it had become invisible. But I feel sure it is still there. Somewhere along the old discontinued GS&WM line. And at times the urge to go and look is almost a frenzy. It usually comes early in the morning when my wife is showering and the kids are watching Batman and Scooby-Doo on Channel 38 out of Boston, and I am feeling the most like the pre-adolescent Gordon LaChance that once strode the earth, walking and talking and occasionally crawling on his belly like a reptile. That boy was me, I think, and the thought which follows, chilling me like a dash of cold water, is, which boy do you mean? Sipping a cup of tea, looking at sun slanting through the kitchen windows, hearing the TV from one end of the house and the shower from the other, feeling the pulse behind my eyes that means I got through one beer too many the night before, I feel sure I could find it. I would see clear metal winking through rust, the bright summer sun reflecting it back to my eyes. I would go down the side of the embankment, push aside the grasses that had grown up and twined roughly around its handle, and then I would... what? Why, simply pull it out of time. I would turn it over and over in my hands, wondering at the feel of it, marveling at the knowledge that the last person to touch it had been long years in his grave. Suppose there was a note in it. Help me, I'm lost. Of course, there wouldn't be. Boys don't go out to pick blueberries with paper and pencil. But just suppose. I imagine the awe I'd feel would be as dark as an eclipse. Still, it's mostly just the idea of holding that pail in my two hands, I guess. As much a symbol of my living as his dying. Proof that I really do know which boy it was, which boy of the five of us, holding it. Reading every year in its cake of rust and the fading of its bright shine. Feeling it, trying to understand the suns that shone on it, the rains that fell on it, and the snows that covered it. And to wonder where I was when each thing happened to it in its lonely place. Where I was, what I was doing, who I was loving, how I was getting along where I was. I'd hold it. read it, feel it, and look at my own face in whatever reflection might be left. Can you dig it? 29. We got back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We had walked all night. Nobody complained, although we all had blisters and were all ravenously hungry. My head was throbbing with a killer headache, and my legs felt twisted and burning with fatigue. Twice we had to scramble down the embankment to get out of the way of freights. One of them was going our way, but moving far too fast to hop. It was seeping daylight when we got to the trestle spanning the castle again. Chris looked at it, looked at the river, looked back at us. Fuck it. I'm walking across. If I get hit by a train, I won't have to watch out for fucking Ace Merrill. We all walked across it. Plodded might be the better verb. No train came. When we got to the dump, we climbed the fence. No Milo and no Chopper, not this early, and not on a Sunday morning. And went directly to the pump. Vern primed it, and we all took turns sticking our heads under the icy flow, slapping the water over our bodies, drinking until we could hold no more. Then we had to put our shirts on again because the morning seemed chilly. We walked, limped, back into town, and stood for a moment on the sidewalk in front of the vacant lot. We looked at our treehouse so we wouldn't have to look at each other. "Well," Teddy said at last, "see you in school on Wednesday. I think I'm going to sleep until then." "Me too," Vern said. "I'm too pooped to pop." Chris whistled tunelessly through his teeth and said nothing. "Hey, man," Teddy said awkwardly. "No hard feelings, okay?" "No," Chris said, and suddenly his somber, tired face broke into a sweet and sunny grin. "We did it, didn't we? We did the bastard." "Yeah," Vern said, "you're fucking A. Now Billy's gonna do me." "So what?" Chris said. "Richie's gonna tool up on me, and Ace is probably gonna tool up on Gordy, and somebody else will tool up on Teddy, but we did it." "That's right," Vern said, but he still sounded unhappy. Chris looked at me. "We did it, didn't we?" he asked softly. "It was worth it, wasn't it?" "Sure it was," I said. "Fuck this," Teddy said in his dry, I'm losing interest way. "You guys sound like fucking meet the press. Give me some skin, man. I'm going to toot home and see if Mom's got me on the 10 most wanted list." We all laughed. Teddy gave us his surprised, "Oh, Lord, what now?" look, and we gave him skin. Then he and Vern started off in their direction, and I should have gone in mine. But I hesitated for a second. "Walk with you," Chris offered. "Sure, okay." We walked a block or so without talking. Castle Rock was awesomely quiet in the day's first light, and I felt an almost holy tiredness is slipping away sort of feeling. We were awake, and the whole world was asleep, and I almost expected to turn the corner and see my deer standing at the far end of Carbine Street, where the GS and WM tracks passed through the mill's loading yard. Finally, Chris spoke. "They'll tell," he said. "You bet they will, but not today or tomorrow, if that's what you're worried about. It'll be a long time before they tell, I think. Years, maybe." He looked at me, surprised. "They're scared, Chris, Teddy especially, that they won't take him in the army. But Vern's scared, too. They'll lose some sleep over it, and there's going to be times this fall when it's right on the tips of their tongues to tell somebody, but I don't think they will. And then, you know what? It sounds fucking crazy, but I think they'll almost forget it ever happened." He was nodding slowly. "I didn't think of it just like that. You see through people, Gordy." "Man, I wish I did." "You do, though." We walked another block in silence. "I'm never going to get out of this town," Chris said, and sighed. "When you come back from college on summer vacation, you'll be able to look me and Vern and Teddy up down at Suki's after the 7-to-3 shift's over. If you want to. Except you'll probably never want to." He laughed a creepy laugh. "Quit jerking yourself off," I said, trying to sound tougher than I felt. I was thinking about being out there in the woods, about Chris saying, "And maybe I took it to old Lady Simons and told her, and maybe the money was all there, and I got a 3-day vacation anyway because the money never showed up. And maybe the next week old Lady Simons had this brand new skirt on when she came to school." The look in his eyes. No jerk-off, Daddy-O, Chris said. I rubbed my first finger against my thumb. This is the world's smallest violin playing My Heart Pumps Purple Piss for You. He was ours, Chris said, his eyes dark in the morning light. We had reached the corner of my street, and we stopped there. It was 6:15. Back toward town, we could see the Sunday Telegram truck pulling up in front of Teddy's uncle's stationery shop. A man in blue jeans and a T-shirt threw off a bundle of papers. They bounced upside down on the sidewalk, showing the color funnies, always Dick Tracy and Blondie on the first page. Then the truck drove on, its driver intent on delivering the outside world to the rest of the whistle stops up the line. Otis Field, Norway, South Paris, Waterford, Stoneham. I wanted to say something more to Chris, and didn't know how to. Give me some skin, man, he said, sounding tired. Chris, skin. I gave him some skin. I'll see you. He grinned, that same sweet, sunny grin. Not if I see you first, fuckface. He walked off, still laughing, moving easily and gracefully, as though he didn't hurt like me and have blisters like me, and like he wasn't lumped and bumped with mosquito and chigger and black fly bites like me. As if he didn't have a care in the world, as if he was going to some real boss place, instead of just home to a three-room house, shack would have been closer to the truth, with no indoor plumbing and broken windows covered with plastic, and a brother who was probably laying for him in the front yard. Even if I'd known the right thing to say, I probably couldn't have said it. Speech destroys the functions of love, I think. That's a hell of a thing for a writer to say, I guess, but I believe it to be true. If you speak to tell a deer you mean it no harm, it glides away with a single flip of its tail. The word is the harm. Love isn't what these asshole poets like McEwen want you to think it is. Love has teeth. They bite. The wounds never close. No word, no combination of words can close those love bites. It's the other way around. That's the joke. If those wounds dry up, the words die with them. Take it from me. I've made my life from the words, and I know that is so. 30. The back door was locked, so I fished the spare key out from under the mat and let myself in. The kitchen was empty. Silence. She was sidely clean. I could hear the hum the fluorescent bars over the sink made when I turned on the switch. It had been literally years since I had been up before my mother. I couldn't even remember the last time such a thing had happened. I took off my shirt and put it in the plastic clothes basket behind the washing machine. I got a clean rag from under the sink and sponged off with it, face, neck, pits, belly. Then I unzipped my pants and scrubbed my crotch, my testicles in particular, until my skin began to hurt. It seemed I couldn't get clean enough down there, although the red wheal left by the bloodsucker was rapidly fading. I still have a tiny crescent-shaped scar there. My wife once asked about it, and I told her a lie before I was even aware I meant to do so. When I was done with the rag, I threw it away. It was filthy. I got out a dozen eggs and scrambled six of them together. When they were semi-solid in the pan, I added a side dish of crushed pineapple and half a quart of milk. I was just sitting down to eat when my mother came in, her gray hair tied in a knot behind her head. She was wearing a faded pink bathrobe and smoking a Camel. Gordon, where have you been? Camping, I said, and began to eat. We started off in Vern's field and then went up the brickyard hill. Vern's mom said she would call you, didn't she? She probably talked to your father, she said, and glided past me to the sink. She looked like a pink ghost. The fluorescent bars were less than kind to her face. They made her complexion look almost yellow. She sighed, almost sobbed. I miss Dennis most in the mornings, she said. I always look in his room, and it's always empty, Gordon. Always. Yeah, that's a bitch, I said. He always slept with his window open and the blankets... Gordon, did you say something? Nothing important, Mom. And the blankets pulled up to his chin, she finished. Then she just stared out the window, her back to me. I went on eating. I was trembling all over.